Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, just over 100 days before the Iowa caucuses, we continue our series of conversations with presidential candidates. My guest this half hour, joining me in the studio, Julian Castro, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Obama administration, also former mayor of San Antonio. Secretary Castro, welcome to our studio.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Want to reach out to our listeners. We have some questions we'll put to you from our social media, which have been coming in the last few hours, but also want to reach out to our listeners at this very moment. Your question for Secretary Castro, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Secretary Castro, during this week's Democratic debate a few days ago, you brought up your visit to Newton, Iowa. That happened, you said, a few weeks ago, and you told in the very few seconds you were given how Newton suffered a devastating blow, losing its Maytag plant about 10 years ago. About at one time, Maytag in Newton employed about 3,000 people. Maytag left town about 10 years ago, now has a firm called TPI that manufactures wind turbines. Now that you have more than a sound bite of time, tell us what you think Newton's story represents in a future economy with even more green jobs.
It represents possibility, the possibility of doing two things that we absolutely need to do in the years to come, which is, number one, to confront the climate crisis, to get to net zero carbon emissions in our country. And, you know, I've put out a plan for us to do that. In other words, to do right by our planet, protect our planet for future generations. That's one thing. The other thing is we can't just see climate change as a crisis. We have to see it as an opportunity as well. And what TPI represents is a spectacular example of the job opportunity that exists as we transition to a clean energy economy. You know, they're employing several hundred people there at TPI in good paying jobs. Obviously, Newton and the folks who live there, and certainly the people who have those jobs, very appreciative of the opportunity to work and be able to provide for their families. You can write that story in other places in Iowa, in my home state of Texas, which of course is led in the traditional energy economy. But earlier this year, there was more wind produced in a given month from Texas than energy produced from wind than from coal. Imagine that in Texas. And there are a lot of jobs in the wind energy industry, the solar energy industry. I know because when I was mayor in San Antonio, we decided to close one of our coal-fired plants and we invested in a 400-megawatt solar facility and incentivized the location of several hundred jobs in the manufacturing of the solar panels. So that's what that represents. It represents possibility.
How do you though convince the people that aren't already convinced that being green makes not only ecological sense, saving the planet, but also can make real economic sense? If you're in a coal-producing state, it may mean your family's a job in your family. And this president, in part, was elected because he wanted to revive the coal industry.
We need to make sure that we're addressing the needs of people who have made their livelihood working, you know, in the coal energy industry or related to fossil fuels, number one, so that they understand that that we want to make sure that they are taken care of, that we're investing in economic development in those areas that will provide other opportunities. One of the problems that I have with a lot of the ways that states do economic development is that oftentimes when we're trying to incentivize these companies to create jobs, a lot of that effort is focused on the big cities and their suburbs. There was a great analysis of my home state of Texas a couple of months ago of this Texas miracle that people like Rick Perry used to talk about and Greg Abbott today, who's the governor. And they analyzed where these jobs that had been incentivized to come to Texas, where they located. And hardly any of them were actually in smaller towns or rural areas. Now, I know that there are certain advantages that cities and suburbs have when it comes to providing for, you know, the infrastructure that companies need. But my point is, we need to do a better job in general at meeting the economic development needs of smaller communities, whether it's here in Iowa or in Texas or in West Virginia or Kentucky or wherever it is, in addition to investing in the ability of people to get the kind of retraining that they need, and looking for opportunities for them to get employed in the clean energy economy that we're going to need to make possible.
Join our conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro, 1-866-780-9100. Steve in Ames dialed that number. Steve, welcome to the program with Julian Castro. What's your question?
Did you ask for Steve?
Yes, Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead, sir.
I'm sorry. Yeah, this is Steve from Ames. The federal budget is growing and growing and growing, and I hear nothing talked about what are your plans to manage this budget deficit that's going to grow uncontrollably if we don't start doing something about it now. What are your plans to manage this growing catastrophe?
Steve, thank you for your question from Ames.
Well, I definitely appreciate the question and certainly understand the concern. I came up originally through local politics. I served on the San Antonio City Council, and then I was mayor of my hometown of San Antonio for 5 years. As many people know, at the local and the state level, you don't have a choice. You have to balance your budget. And so that's what we did when I was councilman and when I was mayor. You know, granted, that is tougher at the federal level, but his question was, what are we going to do about it? And I think we have to do several things about it. Number one, we need to stop these tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit big corporations and the very wealthy.
Reverse the latest tax cuts?
I would reverse the lion's share, almost all of the Trump tax cuts, and replace it with a tax code that actually rewards people who have to work for a living instead of extremely wealthy individuals and very big corporations. I mean, Amazon made more than $11 billion in profit last year, but they didn't pay any federal income tax. And there were 60 other big corporations in this country that either didn't pay any income tax, like Amazon, or they actually got a tax rebate. So we have to do that. We also have to expect more from people at the very top and big corporations and garner more revenue. There are also ways that we can garner revenue to invest in things like affordable housing that aren't strictly about raising the top marginal tax rate or similar things. For instance, when I was housing secretary, we stood up something called the National Housing Trust Fund to try and create more housing that was affordable for very low-income individuals. We did that by putting a transaction fee on the government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Every time they did a transaction, a little bit of money would go into this fund that would then go to the states to create more affordable housing. We need to look for models like that. In addition to that, I have always believed that we need to be better about how we use our resources. I don't care whether you're liberal or you're conservative. You want to make sure if money is being spent on a program, that that program is actually producing results for the dollar that you're investing. That was the attitude that I had when I was at the local level and the attitude that I had when I was at the federal level. And so across the departments of the federal government, we need to make sure that money is being well spent. And that includes the Department of Defense as well. So we need to spend our money well and also end these tax cuts that are giving too much revenue to people at the very top and big corporations and garner more revenue by important changes to the tax code.
Can you make a firm commitment in X number of years that you would eliminate the budget deficit? Wouldn't that be helpful?
Well, I would work to do that.
So give me a number of years and how long would it take to balance the budget and not contribute even more to our national debt?
What I can say is that I'm confident that we would begin reducing that budget deficit immediately. You know, I think that putting an exact number of years on it right now, I wouldn't want to do that. But the commitment I can make is that I would reverse the terrible decisions that this president has made that is making that situation worse.
former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Obama administration with us this hour. Of course, Democratic presidential candidate. He's been in Iowa quite a bit. Former mayor of San Antonio, Texas. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Secretary, have about 10 minutes left. We'll try to get to as many listener questions as possible. This is an email question from Karen listening in Des Moines. She wants to know, what will be your farm policy in relation to climate change mitigation? She asks, will you promote farmer compensation to implement carbon sequestration practices?
Yeah, thank you very much for that question. I absolutely believe that the agricultural industry has a role to play as we combat climate change. And I would invest in ways to incentivize them to update equipment, to engage in practices that help reduce carbon emissions. I believe that there is a role for that. Obviously, this has to be part of a much larger plan to reduce carbon emissions. And I hope that folks will check out my website, juliancastro.com. I have my plan on there. But this includes a goal of getting to net zero by 2045, along with some benchmarks of a clean energy standard and a clean transportation standard as well.
Mm-hmm. Another policy question. This is from Rich, one of our listeners. He says the discussion of healthcare during the debates was largely focused on the practicality of Medicare for all and how that would be funded. He asks, what do you think the public should know about President Trump's plans for healthcare and what is at risk if the ACA is struck down and Republicans remain in position to design the immediate future of healthcare?
You know, the ACA was a very important breakthrough. Seven presidents before Barack Obama had tried to do some form of expanded / universal health care. At one time, as folks will remember, just over 90% of Americans were insured because of the ACA. What's at stake is if this administration continues to undermine the ACA or somehow is actually able to get it overturned, all of those things that people like about the ACA, the fact that your child can stay on your health insurance up until the age of 26, that insurers cannot discriminate based on so-called pre-existing conditions, which too often really are an excuse for them to throw you off or not insure you in the first place.
In the meantime, though, Republicans are on board with those two aspects you just mentioned, though. Those aren't really in danger, are they?
Well, I mean, they say that, but they never really take any action to protect them. And, you know, these folks in Washington have gotten good about, you know, trying to whisper sweet nothings into your ear about the parts that you like and make it look like they're working. But really, you know, they're not really working towards something that is feasible. So I believe that what we need to do and what I've proposed is essentially a system that is based off of Medicare. We would strengthen Medicare for the people who are on it. We would expand Medicare for the people who want it. And then if you have a strong health insurance plan, it's solid, it meets certain benchmarks, I think people should be able to hold on to their health insurance plan if they want to, that we can do both of those things.
And this is where you differ from Senators Warren and Sanders.
You know, even in Senator Sanders' plan, though, it nods toward the availability of a private supplemental health insurance plan, I believe, for people who want to get cosmetic surgery, for instance. Granted, that's very limited, but that also mirrors the approach that other countries have taken, that we consider to have a public healthcare system. There's some ability to have a supplemental or private health insurance plan in many of those.
Mm-hmm. Just over 5 minutes left with Julian Castro, Democratic presidential candidate. In the debates earlier this week, Secretary Castro, you along with the other Democratic candidates said you're in favor of the impeachment inquiry now officially underway for a couple of weeks. However, more than 3 weeks into this Ukraine controversy, there's been little movement in the president's approval rating. He's at over 40%, according to 538's tracker. Polling tracker, down from just a little bit from where he was last month. Here in Iowa, about the same. His approval remains a little bit above 40% if you look at it in the same way. And this is a state that he won by more than 9 percentage points, I'm sure you're well aware of. Why do you believe this president's approval rating remains more or less stable?
Well, I mean, there's no question that we're in a time in this country where we're very polarized by partisanship. And there has been a tendency, I think, too oftentimes for people to just support the person of their party. You know, that doesn't exist just on one party or another. I think that, you know, sometimes people from both sides of the aisle do that. However, I think what you've seen with this president is that these Republican supporters of his, he has just gone off the rails with corruption, with dishonesty, with abuse of power, violating his oath of office. A very good example of that was just yesterday. He announced that they're going to have the G7 summit at his own golf resort, the Doral, in Florida. I mean, imagine that. Imagine if your city council member, your school board member, your mayor said, we're going to go have the biggest event in town at my personal business, at his own personal business, to line his own pockets. And my problem with these Republican congressional representatives, senators, and so forth, is that they don't say anything. Everybody up there who is on his side of the aisle is acting like this is normal. It's not. That's corruption. That meets the definition of a politician who's a crook.
If this impeachment inquiry reveals some serious abuse of power by President Trump, would you, as our next president, push for greater congressional oversight of all future presidents? That would include yourself, limiting your powers, increasing congressional powers.
Oh, I think what's been on display in this whole episode, as Trump has gone off the rails, is how much latitude there is for a president to get away with things that he or she should not be able to get away with.
That was the same accusation was leveled at President Obama when you served under him.
Yeah, but I think that's because you have on the right wing this media ecosystem that turns non-scandals into scandals, whether it's Fox News or, InfoWars or any number of things. I mean, go back and look at each of those things that they tried to bring up, whether it was Benghazi or Fast and Furious or Hillary's emails. All of those were investigated and nothing was found. In contrast to the Mueller report that found 10 instances of this president either obstructing justice or trying to obstruct justice, and basically said, but for a directive from the Department of Justice, this president might well be indicted right now.
Let's go back to questions from our listeners. This is from Kathy. Kathy would like to know your position on classifying the internet as a utility, putting it under a different federal governance, currently under the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission.
Oh, I believe in a democratized internet, and I believe that we should treat it as a utility, as something that is essential. And in so many different ways, I think that it will be beneficial when we treat the internet as not a luxury, but a necessity. That's why at HUD, I worked on something called Connect Home to start a new initiative to connect low-income families living in public housing to broadband so that they would have an opportunity to actually have the internet at home, do homework, look for jobs, college opportunities, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. The progressive wing of your party, represented by candidates Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, believe that only a populist, progressive message can create the enthusiasm needed to beat President Trump, that this country needs really big structural change and that is what people are calling for. As a more moderate figure, how do you counter that argument?
Well, I actually agree with the idea that we need a big structural change. I have been on more on the progressive side of this campaign.
You don't count yourself as a moderate?
No. I mean, I think if you look at my track record and what I've done in this campaign, I fall more toward the progressive side. Obviously, I think it's true with every candidate. You know, I have my disagreements with Bernie and with Elizabeth Warren, but I agree with a lot of the approach that they want to take, because I do think that we have a system that constantly rewards people at the very top at the expense of hardworking families across this country that are getting further and further behind. I saw that very clearly when I traveled the country as housing secretary. I've seen it here in Iowa, and I'm fighting for those folks who need a voice. And I've spotlighted in this campaign people who are getting behind, whether it was homeless people living in storm drainage tunnels underneath the Las Vegas Strip, or a woman living in Waukee in a trailer park that just got her rent jacked up by 60% because a private equity group bought that trailer park. I'm speaking for them.
All right. And finally, in the final minute, we are asking candidates on this program, because of the strenuous nature of campaigning in Iowa, how long it is, how long the campaign lasts here. What do you do to stay in shape on the campaign trail, mentally and physically?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of travel, right? So I, in the last, I don't know, maybe 3 months, 4 months, I started improving what I eat. I probably lost about 6 to 8 pounds or something.
You have?
Yeah. I run on the treadmill. I wish that I were as religious about it as I need to be. I'd like to run like 4 times a week, but sometimes that's only 2, sometimes it's 3. Just watching what I eat, trying to get to sleep at a decent hour when I can, and then also running on the treadmill.
What's your favorite healthy meal? Put it on a plate for me.
I eat a lot of salmon. Salmon with some greens, you know, whether it's green beans or spinach or I really like Brussels sprouts.
All right. In just the 30 seconds we have remaining, what's on your schedule yet today?
We have a roundtable that's focused on people who have been incarcerated and how we ensure that their reentry into society is smooth and give them good opportunity. And then we're going off to Davenport later today for a little town hall there.
All right. Thank you very much. Former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Julian Castro, is also, of course, a Democratic presidential candidate. Secretary Castro, we appreciate you coming into the studio today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, or rather Monday, it is Friday already, isn't it? Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg will be on the program. His new book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. He's a practicing psychiatrist in Manhattan, and his sister suffered from serious mental illness. He'll tell that story along with what messages he has for our mental health care in this country on Monday. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Also help from Julia Di Giacomo. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.